Doctors and patients love new technology, but sometimes there may be unexpected complications that take years to discover. This is the People's Pharmacy with Terry and Joe Graydon.
Operations to repair hernias are among the most common surgeries performed in the world today. Surgeons have been improving their techniques over the last few decades. But are there unanticipated consequences of the new technology?
It can take years or even decades to uncover dangerous drug side effects. Why does it take the FDA so long to find them and warn the public?
Coming up on The People's Pharmacy, call in your questions and stories about long-term drug side effects and how you decide when it's safe to take a new medicine.
First, this news.
Welcome to The People's Pharmacy. I'm Terry Graydon. I'm a medical anthropologist.
And I'm Joe Graydon. I'm a pharmacologist. Today, we're going to be talking about unintended consequences. You know, medications that may have side effects that aren't detected for years or even decades. Dietary supplements have some surprising downsides. This week, we learned about potential problems with fish oil and artificial sweeteners. We'll be talking about the research and taking your calls later in the show.
But first, we'll talk about one of the most common surgical procedures performed in the world today. Hernia repair is supposed to be straightforward, a one-time fix. Yet some people end up with post-operative problems. To find out why, we're talking with a leading expert on hernia surgery.
Dr. Todd Hannaford is chief of the Division of Gastrointestinal and Minimally Invasive Surgery and director of the Carolinas Hernia Center at Carolinas Healthcare System in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Welcome to the People's Pharmacy, Dr. Hannaford.
Thank you.
Dr. Hannaford, you are, you know, clearly one of the country's leading experts in the field of hernia surgery. But first, why don't you just tell us, what is a hernia?
Well, a hernia is a weakness or a hole, typically in your abdominal wall. It can be at your belly button. It can be really anywhere on your abdominal wall or even in your groin. Usually how patients notice it is they can be sore there, have some discomfort with standing, with lifting, and frequently they'll see a protrusion. And that protrusion can be fatty tissue from inside their abdomen or perhaps even intestine. They're usually what ends up happening is they'll see this, one of their family members will see this, they'll go to their family doctor, and they get diagnosed with a hernia.
How common are hernias, and how frequently are hernia surgeries performed in this country?
Well, hernias, not only in this country but around the world, it results in the most common operation performed in the world and in this country. There'll be about 1 million hernia repairs in the United States. Not everyone who has a hernia will have it repaired, but the majority of folks who are otherwise healthy will eventually come to a hernia repair. But there are lots of hernias. Patients who have a hernia should feel like they're a member of a big club, no question.
Now, you've suggested that there are an awful lot of us walking around with hernias of one sort or another, and that some of them don't need surgery and others do. Could you describe for us, please, the patients who would benefit from a surgical hernia repair?
Well, I mean, that's really a personal question for a lot of folks. Hernias, for the most part, there are a few things about reasons to get a hernia repaired. One is that hernias do not fix themselves. There's nothing you can do. There's no pill. There's no exercising. I have people will say, well, if I strengthen my abdominal wall, will my hernia go away? There's really nothing you can do about it. And some people look at themselves and say, well, this is a problem with me. And the answer to that is no. Most of the time, hernias come due to genetics or in the previous surgical incision or because you got pregnant and really expanded your abdominal wall and increased your abdominal pressure and that sort of thing. So they don't fix themselves. They tend to get bigger with time. So if you have a young patient who has a hernia, most of the time, at some point, they're going to come to have their hernia repaired just because it starts to become bigger, become more unsightly.
Dr. Hannaford, that's a really important point. Unsightly. I mean, how many people get a hernia repair because they see this sort of bulge in their abdominal wall and they just don't like the way it looks, even though they feel fine and they have no symptoms and it might not cause them problems?
Many of them do. especially in their anterior abdominal wall, like a belly button hernia or other type of ventral abdominal hernia, which the ventral abdomen is the front of your abdomen. People will see that, or you can see it through a T-shirt. They don't like the way it looks, and they will have it repaired. Absolutely. And the cosmetic part of that is a key component, especially if you have a thin person. And I see it frequently in women who've had children. They end up with an umbilical hernia where they've stretched their abdominal wall, and it's very prominent when they wear any sort of tight – it doesn't even have to be tight or clingy clothing. You can see this lump through their abdominal wall there.
But what you're saying is that for many of these folks, no worries, not a problem?
Well, I wouldn't say no worries, but you know, as I mentioned, you know, the first two reasons, these things don't go away, hernias don't go away, they get bigger with time. Patients are at risk that tissue that's coming through could get incarcerated, which means it gets stuck. And if it gets stuck, it actually can become strangulated. The neck of the hernia, the opening in your abdominal wall or your groin, grows slowly. But if the tissue becomes edematous, then that opening can act as a noose. And then that tissue that comes through can become vascularly compromised and can become ischemic, and will require an emergency surgery. When I was a young surgeon, I used to scare patients. I didn't know any better. Would scare patients and say, you have to have this repaired because it can become strangulated. We now know that the chance of that is really quite small.
So the chance is low, but forgive me, Dr. Hennerford, you used a lot of big words while you described what it means to have a strangulated hernia. Can we go back and just review what that would feel like and what it would imply?
Yes, ma'am. When you get tissue that comes through your hernia that you can't push back in, most hernias we can push back in. If you can't get it pushed back in, then we would call that incarcerated, that the tissue is stuck there and can't be manipulated, massaged, and put back into the abdomen.
Are you said ischemic.
When the tissue becomes stuck or incarcerated, that doesn't necessarily mean that the tissue will become ischemic. But it can result in ischemia of the tissue. If the tissue comes out and the blood supply to that tissue is compromised by the opening in the hernia, the neck of the hernia, then the tissues can become ischemic or even strangulated, and then those patients would need an emergency operation. That's what we want to try and avoid, really, with hernia repairs. But that happens very infrequently.
How would somebody know if they were getting into trouble?
For the most part, pain is a huge indicator. Most hernias that are going to get you in trouble become symptomatic first, most of them, not all of them. And so once patients start to become symptomatic, then most of them will see their physician or see their surgeon and get it repaired. But occasionally, asymptomatic hernias, patient didn't even know they had a hernia, can become incarcerated and even require an emergency operation. But pain is the biggest indicator. Another indicator would be is if your intestine is stuck in there, then patients actually develop an obstruction of their intestines. Things will back up in their stomach. They become nauseated and have nausea and vomiting. And you can have, if you know you have a hernia, sometimes you'll see skin changes. Your skin over the hernia will become red and a bit inflamed. And if that happens and associated with discomfort, you really need to see your physician.
How soon do you need to see that doctor?
Right away. This is if your intestine's involved and you can't really tell. Even physicians examining someone frequently can't tell if their intestine's involved or not. And so if your hernia has changes, if it becomes incarcerated, if it becomes more painful, if the combination of those two, you need to see physicians right away. If it's 10 o'clock at night, you need to, if you have a surgeon, call them or otherwise go to the emergency room and be seen, because this can become, over 8 hours, can make a real big difference in your outcome.
Dr. Hennerford, once somebody has identified a hernia as a problem and the physician says it's time for surgery, what's next? This is an area that you have specialized in for many, many years. Tell us a little bit about the surgical techniques, and then let's talk about a very controversial topic, mesh.
Yes, sir. Well, once someone decides they're going to have their hernia repaired, one thing that's very important is to find the surgeon that's skilled in it. You want to, just like you would want to find a very good cardiologist, you'd want to find a very good surgeon to take care of your hernia. There are numerous techniques to repair just about any hernia. And one of the things that will certainly be important is to explore what the surgeon's how many times he's done a particular technique, what his outcomes are, risk of infection, and all of those things. Chance of recurrence, what your hospital stay will be, how long will you be out of work, a number of questions that you should go through with your surgeon. Your surgeon should be ready, willing, and able and spend the time with you to answer that. Draw pictures for you. Make sure that you are fully aware of what you're getting yourself into. For the most part, for decades, we repaired hernias primarily, which means we used the patient's own tissues to repair the hernia. In some hernias, like small umbilical hernias, that can work well. In larger hernias involving the abdominal wall and hernias of the groin, they tend to have a much higher recurrence rate. A recurrence rate in the groin by simply suturing someone's tissues together can be as high as 20% with long-term follow-up. We, as surgeons, and most surgeons, have adopted techniques to use mesh to repair hernias, and essentially hernias anywhere, in the ventral abdomen, umbilical hernias, and also in your groin. And what has happened with the use of mesh is that we've driven down the chance of hernia recurrence pretty dramatically. The chance in the hands of a surgeon who really knows how to take care of a groin hernia, the recurrence rate should be 1% to 2% for your lifetime. It should be really quite low.
Oh, what's the mesh made of that you're using in this repair?
The meshes are made of a lot of different materials. There are synthetic meshes as well as biologic meshes now that have come out onto the market in the last 10 to 15 years. Synthetic meshes, the most common, are polypropylene. Essentially, they are a derivative of the oil industry. They're a petroleum derivative. Polypropylene mesh was first invented in the 1950s by a gentleman in Houston, Texas, of course, around the oil industry. And that mesh that was used back then, essentially the same chemical compound is used, but the way the mesh is made has changed. We now have polyester meshes, as well as meshes made of PTFE or Gore-Tex, much like the same company that makes Gore-Tex for your fabrics, for your clothing, also makes a mesh for hernia repair. The biologic meshes, which are typically used in the face of infection or in patients who have a real high risk of infection, come from pig skin and human skin and other areas such as cow pericardium or fetal calf skin and a lot of other areas like that. The cells are taken out of the mesh. The antigens, which can cause an allergic reaction, are also removed from the mesh. The mesh is sterilized, processed, and we can actually use that to buttress your own tissues.
You're listening to Dr. Todd Hennifer, director of the Carolinas Hernia Center and chief of the Division of Gastrointestinal and Minimally Invasive Surgery at Carolinas Healthcare System in Charlotte, North Carolina.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll hear more from Dr. Hennifer about the pros and cons of surgical mesh. What is all the controversy about? Does it make sense to have surgery without mesh? And what can be done for dissatisfied patients?
You're listening to The People's Pharmacy with Joe and Terry Graydon.
Welcome back to The People's Pharmacy. I'm Joe Graydon.
And I'm Terry Graydon. The People's Pharmacy is made possible by Red X Industries, makers of Utter Cream and Utterly Smooth Extra Care Cream enriched with urea to moisturize dry, cracked skin. 800-345-7339. Online at uttercream.com.
And by We Patients, where you can learn from others about possible triggers and potential treatments for your headaches or migraines. Online at wepatients.com.
If you'd like to order a CD of this show, you can call 800-732-2334. It's show number 910. Or visit our website, peoplespharmacy.com.
Today we're talking about unintended consequences. Shortly, we'll find out about the new research on fish oil and prostate cancer. We'll also discuss why potent acid-suppressing drugs might be hard on the heart. If you have a question about those stories, you can give us a call, 888-472-3366, email us, radio@peoplespharmacy.com, or send us a message through Twitter, @peoplespharmacy. But first...
Let's hear more about hernia repairs and surgical mesh from Dr. Todd Hannaford. He's chief of the Division of Gastrointestinal and Minimally Invasive Surgery and director of the Carolinas Hernia Center at Carolinas Healthcare System in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Well, what does the mesh look like? I mean, I think of cheesecloth as, you know, a kind of a mesh-like material, and I'm sort of imagining cheesecloth that's made out of plastic.
You know, that's a great way to describe. I'm going to have to steal that from you, actually. I really like that description. I usually describe it as growing up in very rural South Carolina as almost like a screen on your back porch, and except it's made from a very soft plastic. The meshes that we use now have very wide pores, and the weight of the mesh, how much foreign body we put in, has dropped dramatically over the last decade.
Well, speaking of mesh, as we are, it has become a very controversial topic. If one looks at hernia repair and mesh on the web, you see a lot of lawyers circling like vultures. I suspect there's a reason for that, and you've already alluded to the possibility of infection. So can you tell us about the pros and the cons of mesh? Because part of what you do in your practice is deal with some of the negative consequences.
There's no question. When I talk to patients, much like I stated earlier, when you put a synthetic material in someone for hernia repair, a mesh, there's no question we can decrease the recurrence rate. And we know that if a patient has a recurrence of their hernia, repair of that hernia and the risk of complications is significantly higher than in their primary operation. So we want to do the best job we can at their first surgery. The other side of the scale, let's say, is that if you put a synthetic material in, you increase the risk of infection. And there is no question that any material, especially any foreign material that we put into a patient, can become infected, whether it's a heart valve or replace a blood vessel or a mesh for a hernia repair. And the consideration of what mesh that it is to be used is very important. There are lots and lots of types of meshes out there. And we've spent I have spent a lot of my professional life studying those meshes. The meshes that we have found that work the best are the simplest, perhaps. The lightweight, wide-pore monofilament, which means there's single strands of mesh woven together knitted together to make a screen for a repair. The pendulum has swung hard to using mesh, and there has been now a pushback in not using mesh. And there are websites now, you can see that surgeons advertise, well, I'll fix your hernia and not use mesh. But one thing we don't want to do is fall back too far to where we came, and then you end up with patients who have recurrent hernias, and hernias that are certainly more difficult to repair. Greater chance of complications, greater chance of recurrence because it is a recurrent hernia, and also the greater chance of having discomfort after a recurrent hernia. I think it is a very important topic, but you have to weigh both sides of this.
If a patient comes to you, Dr. Hannaford, and says, I've been reading about the dangers of mesh, and I see that the problem rate is anywhere from 5 to 30%, and I just don't want to take that risk, can you do this without mesh? And can you do this without general anesthesia? What do you respond?
Well, obviously they're talking about a groin hernia. And what I try to talk to patients about is for the most part, we have to define, you know, where you are right now. If a patient comes in, let's say I'm 48 years old, I come in, I have a unilateral hernia, it's not causing me a lot of trouble. My chance of chronic discomfort with mesh is only about 6%. And the chance of me having a recurrent hernia, if I simply suture your tissues back together again, is somewhere around 20%. So the chance of you having a long-term problem if I don't use mesh is higher than if I use mesh. And there are techniques and there are specific meshes that I use because they've turned out well in the laboratory. We use a very lightweight polypropylene mesh for most of these cases. It is more resistant to infection because it is less mass. There's less for the bacteria to cling on to. So I use a very lightweight mesh, wide pores, and use as lightweight a mesh as I can in any patient. And one of the things that we, can we do this under local anesthesia? Of course we can. Most of those cases I mentioned 2 years ago, we were in Mongolia, and we did about 90 hernia repairs. Almost all of them were under local anesthesia. There are certain centers in the country that will say, we do not use mesh, we simply do a tissue repair. But I can tell you certainly that they don't know what their true outcomes are. And one in particular really advertises this hard, but when I was in Cleveland, I repaired 3 of their failed hernias in 1 month, which would have covered all of their hernia repairs for over a year if you did the statistics.
Dr. Hannaford, you see a lot of dissatisfied patients from all over the country, people who have been in chronic pain or who have chronic infections after mesh has been placed for their hernia repair. What do you do for them?
What we'd like to do for patients, and one of the most important things I can do for them, is ask them what their goals are. And we try and work toward those goals. Sometimes, like with mesh infections, we can treat them chronically with antibiotics, an oral antibiotic, and that's all they want. And if we can get their mesh infection under control and they can live a normal life by taking an antibiotic a day, that's what they would prefer. And some patients, we have to operate on them. Some patients with pain, we end up removing the previous mesh. And there are 3 small nerves that go through the groin, the sensory nerves. Sometimes we end up having have to cut those or clip those and then re-repairing their hernia. It's a fairly complex workup for either one of those problems, but working with the patient toward their goals, not my goals, but their goals, is what's important.
Dr. Todd Hannaford, thank you very much for talking with us on the People's Pharmacy today.
Well, thank you for the invitation. I truly appreciate it.
You've been listening to Dr. Todd Hannaford, Chief of the Division of Gastrointestinal and Minimally Invasive Surgery, Co-Director of the Carolinas Laparoscopic and Advanced Surgery Program, and Director of the Carolinas Hernia Center at Carolinas Healthcare System in Charlotte, North Carolina. He's also Clinical Professor of Surgery at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
His app for helping you tell whether you need hernia surgery is called SEQUAL, for Carolina's Equation for Quality of Life. That's SEQUAL. It's available in the Apple and the Droid app stores. It parses all the data available from various hernia studies to help patients and doctors figure out what the results are likely to be from hernia repair, what their risks are likely to be, and help patients decide whether to go forward with surgery.
We have a link to a video about the app from our website. You can also hear more from Dr. Hannaford about hiatal hernia, the frequency of mesh problems, and the pros and cons of biologic mesh in an extended interview at peoplespharmacy.com.
Now we open our phone lines for your calls and questions. 888-472-3366. There were quite a few controversial health stories about unanticipated complications this week. Fish fats and prostate cancer, acid-suppressing drugs and heart disease, even the counterintuitive impact of artificial sweeteners. We'll also talk about the marijuana munchies. Why don't people gain weight?
If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 888- 472-3366. You can email us radio@peoplespharmacy.com or contact us via Twitter. We're at People's Pharmacy. Have you suffered unexpected complications from a medication, a dietary supplement, or an herb? What about hernia repair? That number again to join the conversation, 888-472-3366.
Thanks for reminding us that supplements and herbs can sometimes result in unexpected complications. We got an email 2 or 3 weeks ago from a person who said, I was taking St. John's wort and I got the worst sunburn of my life. And although this shouldn't really be an unanticipated consequence, we have known that St. John's wort can sensitize the skin. Nonetheless, sometimes it does take people by surprise.
Well, I think what really took people by surprise this week was the news that fish and or fish oil might increase the risk of prostate cancer. So what was the story? Well, this is a complicated study because it was really designed originally to determine whether or not selenium or vitamin E would be beneficial. It turned out neither of them were in preventing prostate cancer.
So that was like an experiment.
That was an experiment. That was randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled. But the fish oil study was an epidemiological study. And what I mean by that was they took a blood sample from these men at the very beginning of the trial. and they stored the blood. And then they waited to see who got prostate cancer and matched them up with people who didn't. And what they found is when they went back and they looked at blood levels of omega-3 fats, they found that there was an association. I have to emphasize, association. This is not cause and effect. This isn't proof. This is an association because it's not the high-quality randomized control trials that really give us the inside story. What they did find was that the men who had in their blood higher levels of omega-3 fats did have an increased risk of developing prostate cancer.
Do they know where those omega-3 fats coming from? Were the guys eating fish or were they taking fish oil supplements?
They don't have that answer because apparently they didn't solicit that information. Most of the men were not taking fish oil supplements, it turns out. So I think there are a lot of us who have some problems with this trial in that it was just a one snapshot, one picture of their blood fats at the very beginning of this trial and did not reflect what they did over the pursuit, you know, the following years. In addition, what we really don't know is, okay, could fish, eating fish, really increase your risk of prostate cancer? That seems somewhat counterintuitive given all of the studies that have gone on over the last couple of decades showing that people who eat fish actually seem to be healthier.
Right, people who eat fish, but not necessarily people who take fish oil.
Well, that's true. I mean, the studies on fish oil are a little bit puzzling because there were two studies, one a randomized controlled trial from Italy, just recently published in the New England Journal of Medicine, showing no benefit in high-risk cardiovascular cases. The other, a meta-analysis in the Journal of the American Medical Association, again showing no real benefit over these randomized controlled trials in preventing heart disease or death from heart attacks. So there's a lot that we don't know, and I think the bottom line is eat fish.
Right. But not every day necessarily,
no,
but include it in your diet.
And if you're at high risk for prostate cancer, you might want to cut back on the fish oil supplements. 888-472-3366 is the number to call. Let's go to Patricia. Well, we're not quite ready for Patricia, but she's almost ready for us. Now we're ready for Patricia. Hi, Patricia. Where are we talking to you?
Hi, Joe and Terry. I read the article on your on my newsletter from People's Pharmacy Online, and the thing that concerns me is the headlines are saying fish oil can cause it can increase the risk of prostate cancer. Well, that's not what the, if you read the article, just as you pointed out, that's not the issue at all. And it's really not a study, but as you called it, a snapshot. And I just called it an analysis. But it's really very alarming to me that with people being encouraged to follow the Mediterranean diet, eating more fish, then this comes out and it scares everybody. And the toxins that we live with could be contributing to prostate cancer in the water, in the air, in the, a workplace. And so I'm just so concerned. I'm glad you're covering it. And hopefully people will hear this and not just the headlines saying fish oil supplements will cause prostate cancer.
Well, thank you for that, Patricia, because we too agree with you that the headlines were very misleading. That's why we try to get to the stories behind the health headlines on the People's Pharmacy. I think a lot of people drew the conclusion, and we saw that certainly on the evening news, that fish oil pills were the problem. And clearly, that's not what this study revealed. In fact, as I said earlier, they didn't know whether the men were actually taking fish oil supplements or eating fish. And I think at this point, discouraging men from following a Mediterranean-type diet or eating fish and substituting burgers, for example, would be a very big mistake.
Well, in fact, there are previous epidemiological studies showing that men who eat more red meat are at higher risk for prostate cancer, whether it's causative or simply an association. We don't know about that either.
Exactly. So, you know, we have to let this all settle for a while. We really need much better trials before we make any final conclusions. We have just a minute or two before we go to the break. Andy in Wentworth, North Carolina. What's this about an abdominal hernia problem?
Hi, Joe and Terry. This is Andy Bell, and what I've got is an abdominal hernia, an umbilical cord hernia.
Mm-hmm.
I'd had it most of my life, and I had it repaired, and they did use a mesh, or I was told they did, and very shortly after the surgery, sutures came through, started protruding back through my skin. I went back to the surgeon, and he said, oh, this happens every once in a while, and he snipped them off and massaged the area a little bit and said, oh, you'll be fine. Well, it turns out that they came back through and are still protruding, and this is for several years, and the hernia is returned triple what it was to start with.
Oh, dear.
I'm sorry to hear about that. That is really discouraging.
And that, you know, of course, is not supposed to happen with surgical mesh. That's supposed to reduce the risk of having to go back and redo the surgery. We're sorry to hear it. We're glad that you apparently have not had an infection, however. And that's one of the big complications that people worry about is the infection caused by the mesh itself. But we're sorry to hear you had problems, proving that sometimes surgery doesn't always work out quite the way we'd like it to. We are going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to talk about proton pump inhibitors. You know, the acid-suppressing drugs that are so popular, like Prilosec and Prevacid and Nexium, the purple pill. An unexpected consequence that might have something to do with your heart and not a good thing.
And we're going to talk about artificial sweeteners. Should you be drinking diet sodas to stay healthy? We'll find out what one researcher thinks.
We're also going to look at medical marijuana. Is it possible that pot could actually help control blood sugar? Wow, now that would be controversial.
What an interesting idea.
And we're going to take your calls more about fish oil and how to get off proton pump inhibitors. You can join the conversation by calling 888-472-3366, or if you can't get through on the phone, just email us radio@peoplespharmacy.com or via Twitter @peoplespharmacy. That number again, 888-472-3366.
You're listening to The People's Pharmacy with Joe and Terry Graydon.
Welcome back to The People's Pharmacy. I'm Joe Graydon.
And I'm Terry Graydon. The People's Pharmacy is brought to you in part by Red-X Industries, makers of Utterly Smooth Foot Cream with Shea Butter, helping dry, cracked feet feel soft and smooth. 800-345-7339. The website, uttercream.com.
And by We Patients, where you can learn from others about possible triggers and potential treatments for your headaches or migraines, online at wepatients.com.
You can purchase a CD of this show if you wish. Just call 800-732-2334. It's show number 910. Or you can find it on our website, peoplespharmacy.com.
We're talking about unintended consequences of surgery, medications, or dietary supplements like fish oil. Have you ever experienced intense itching after stopping an antihistamine like Zyrtec? What about tendinitis as a consequence of a fluoroquinolone antibiotic like Cipro or Levaquin? Has your blood sugar gone up while taking a statin-type cholesterol-lowering drug such as atorvastatin or simvastatin? If you'd like to ask a question or tell us your story, you can call 888-472-3366. Email us, radio@peoplespharmacy.com. You can join the conversation. Again, 888-472-3366.
Joe, this is very exciting.
Dr. Brasky's on the phone?
Dr. Brasky is on the phone from Ohio State University. Welcome to the People's Pharmacy, Dr. Brasky. Thank you for calling.
Hi, how are you? My sister happens to live in one of your calling areas.
Well, we have been following your research very carefully this week, and needless to say, you have made headlines all across the world. Why don't you share your insights?
Well, actually, so I just heard a little bit of your commentary, and I think it's a very good review. One of the things I wanted to mention is that when we measure blood level, we're measuring red blood cell. We can look at red blood cells, or we can look at plasma or serum. when we look at plasma in particular, plasma phospholipid fatty acids tend to reflect, it is, as you point out, a snapshot, but it reflects longer-term dietary intake. With regard to our findings with prostate cancer, we feel that since, and as you rightly mentioned, we're not looking at fish oil supplements directly, we're looking at a blood level of these fatty acids. We tend to feel that because men who would be taking supplements would be getting incredibly high doses of these omega-3s, that's why we've tended to recommend by inference that men should probably try to avoid them. We agree generally, my co-authors and I, that eating whole foods, salmon and fish and so on, are a better way to get your nutrients in general. But again, we think that men should be moderating this intake, given the results of this study and the fact that prostate cancer is the number one cancer in men.
Dr. Braske, one of the things that we were really searching for in your paper, and I honestly couldn't find it anyplace, was how many of the men were taking supplements versus how many of the men were eating fish.
I've heard your commentary. Yeah. It's not that we didn't collect these data; it's that these data are still being analyzed.
Aha! The implication was that most of the men were not taking supplements. Is that true?
I believe that is correct. It would be a larger proportion than if it were the general population, because this happened to be a trial that involved men taking supplements, which is to say that they were asked to take selenium and or vitamin E.
Right.
But nevertheless, it would not be a population of supplement users per se. It would just be a larger proportion of fish oil supplement users than you would generally expect, I suppose.
You're saying
I
that
don't have the numbers.
That presumably is because these men volunteered for your study, which randomized them to take either vitamin E or selenium or placebo of either one.
From the original trial, that's correct.
So, Dr. Braske, first of all, we are very grateful that you have taken time out of your busy schedule to call in today. But what is the take-home message? Because there's a lot of confusion out there. I mean, I think that, as you've said, you know, we still want people to eat a heart-healthy diet, which would include fish, and not substitute red meat, for example, for their salmon.
Well, so it's confusing because we're seeing more and more research come out that starts to question the appropriateness of the statements that omega-3s, particularly long-chain omega-3s coming from fish and fish oil, are heart healthy. So with sort of disconcerting evidence coming out, you've mentioned, I think, the review article in JAMA from, what was it, last year, we're concerned that may not be appropriate. We're also sort of more generally concerned that we have this idea of food as good and bad with no gray area in between. And I think it's time to start moving away from that. And unfortunately, we need to look at foods from the standpoint of how those nutrients might affect one disease versus another. And unfortunately, they may happen differently and even have opposing effects for different cancers. There's a good amount of evidence out there that omega-3s may actually reduce the risk of breast cancer, for instance, in women. And it's very difficult to sort of tease apart these mechanisms. But with regard to what the bottom line is right now, we're thinking that men should probably at least moderate that intake of fatty fish and probably avoid fish oil supplementation, since it, again, comes in such high doses.
Well, and as you point out, good foods versus bad foods, no one food is either good or bad, although a few might fall in towards the more negative category, but it's the diet. So once in a while, fish, but not every day.
That's our feeling on the matter, yeah.
And Dr. Braske, have you given up on fish?
No.
Okay.
No, I still eat it.
All right. Thank you so much for calling, and we really appreciate it. Bye-bye. That was Dr. Stephen Braske, one of the key authors of the article that was just published this past week, titled Plasma Phospholipid Fatty Acids and Prostate Cancer Risk in the SELECT Trial. It was just published in the Journal of the National Cancer Institute.
Right, and that's the study that we've just been talking about regarding fish oil, and the risk of prostate cancer.
Now, we promised we were going to talk about proton pump inhibitors, and this is really quite fascinating because, you know, people have been taking these PPIs, you know, Prilosec and Prevacid, and the generic names are Omeprazole and Lansoprazole, and also Nexium, the purple pill, for almost two decades. And there's been a little study that suggests that there might be a major adverse cardiovascular event, MACE, as a result of these drugs. And now we have a study that was just published in Circulation online July 3rd, suggesting that PPIs may reduce levels of something called nitric oxide.
Oh, and they have a very fancy mechanism for it. They've worked out the biochemistry, which I don't know if we want to get into.
We won't get into the ADMA. This is an inhibitor of nitric oxide. But basically, nitric oxide dilates blood vessels and makes them more flexible. It's really one of those crucial chemicals in your body that does good things. Just think Viagra and Cialis, you know?
Well, it does good things beyond that, too.
Yes, but the way those drugs work is they make increased levels of nitric oxide in the blood vessels, dilate increased blood flow to the penis, then you get your erection. So nitric oxide plays a key role for the heart, for the penis, for your whole body.
Well, interestingly enough, there are foods that can increase your body's production of nitric oxide, and those foods help lower your blood pressure. And they include dark green leafy vegetables, especially beet greens and spinach, and they also include dark chocolate.
Which is, you know, not only tasty, but good for you.
Yeah.
So the proton pump inhibitors, these acid suppressors, do just the opposite. They reduce nitric oxide levels. Maybe not such a good thing for people with heart problems. They also may increase the risk for infections like pneumonia and C. diff. They also lower B12 and magnesium levels, and there's some concern about increased risk of fractures. And we've heard from a lot of people that if they stop a proton pump inhibitor suddenly, they may experience rebound hyperacidity, nasty, nasty heartburn. So very interesting issues. Let's go back to the phones, Terry.
Well, let's talk to Julia and see what she has to say. Welcome to the People's Pharmacy, Julia. What's your comment?
Good morning. Good morning, Joe and Terry. Yes, you mentioned using marijuana medicinally, and 10 years ago had a major reaction to prescription drugs. And at the time, I was losing weight, could not gain weight, under 100 pounds for 4 years. And was in a group, and a lady was smoking dope, and something was said about using marijuana medicinally. And I talked to my PhD psychologist with a joint finger pursed about whether or not it would be advisable for me to try as an old hippie. And he said absolutely no, that in our older age, marijuana reacts to us differently than it did when we were tens, teens, and 20s. And I was wondering if you have documented or heard any of that.
Julie, I'm going to ask you to just listen to our answer. And the answer is, I don't think your doctor actually had the research, because there isn't very much research. There is an editorial in the American Journal of Medicine for July, in which the editor of the journal comments on the research article that was published in the journal, and the editor himself actually says that he has found it quite helpful from time to time to prescribe marijuana to his older patients who don't have any appetite, and it helps them with their appetite, it helps them feel calmer, and he thinks that it's helpful in those situations. He's found it useful as a physician, and so he was quite pleased to see that there is now a little bit of research. There hasn't been very much research on the physiological effects of marijuana, but now there is this study, which really was quite impressive, because what they found was that, and again, it's epidemiology. It's not a clinical trial per se, in which you give marijuana to some people and you give a placebo marijuana to others. This was part of the Haines study, which is the Health and Nutrition Examination Survey. Almost 5,000 people were included in the analysis, and what they found is that the people who reported smoking marijuana within the past month had lower fasting glucose, lower insulin, less insulin resistance, higher HDL cholesterol, which is the good stuff, and smaller waist circumferences, all of which means that they're at lower risk for metabolic syndrome and for diabetes. So it's really quite fascinating.
Well, it came as quite a surprise. I mean, the idea that smoking marijuana could actually be beneficial metabolically, that was a surprise.
It's not actually clear that it should have been such a surprise, though, because there is a weight loss drug that's approved in Europe, but not in the U.S., a drug called Rimonabant that has all of those activities, and it works not by making you high, but it does work through the cannabinoid receptors in the brain.
888-472-3366 is the number to call if you'd like to join the conversation. We go to Salem, Virginia. Robin, what's on your mind?
Hi. I was wondering if you could answer a question about the acid suppressors you mentioned earlier and why when you buy them over the counter, they're always suggesting it should only be a 14-day course of treatment instead of a long-term solution for heartburn or reflux.
Well, Robin, you just heard probably Joe's long list of things that proton pump inhibitors can eventually do if you take them long enough. The pneumonia, the gastrointestinal infection, the risk of fractures, et cetera. And that's part of the reason. The other part is that it's really difficult to stop these drugs if you take them for a month or two or even a little bit longer. It can become very, very hard to stop because you get rebound heartburn.
You know, I think what the FDA was trying to do was encourage people to just use them for a short-term heartburn problem. And that if somebody actually had reflux or serious heartburn, that they would be under medical supervision and that the physician would be giving them a better dose for a longer period of time and supervising their treatment.
I'm not sure it makes sense to use a proton pump inhibitor for a short-term heartburn problem.
Well, I agree. It doesn't necessarily make sense to me either. And in part, to be very honest with you, Robin, I think they're sort of covering their derrieres. And this is sort of a way of letting the drug out over the counter, but saying, you know, just like with ibuprofen, don't use it for more than a week or two. A lot of people completely ignore those warnings. And I think sometimes get into trouble as a result. So does that make any sense, Robin?
It does. Thank you so much.
And thank you. Bye-bye. You know, anybody who's on a proton pump inhibitor for a long period of time needs to be very careful about their magnesium levels, not just their calcium levels, and especially get more vitamin B12. Terry, what are some of the symptoms of B12 deficiency?
Well, we think of B12 as having an impact on the nervous system. So people might have tingling or numbness in their fingers or in their feet. They might have burning tongue. They might find that they're having more memory difficulties or they're confused. And we worry about B12 causing a reversible dementia.
We have a call coming in from St. Petersburg, Florida, Terry, but we aren't going to have time to take it. But this caller wants to know about the artificial sweeteners. Can
yes.
you do this in 1 minute?
I'm going to do it as quickly as I can. The research, the article actually is a summary of human research to see whether or not it agrees with the rat research that the scientist Susan Swithers has done. She's at Purdue University. And what she's found in her rat research is that artificial sweeteners upset the body and brain's connection, the expectation. So a sweet taste, eating sweet food, triggers all kinds of chemical reactions in your body to get it ready to process calories. And when you get a sweet taste and then you don't get calories, those things get disjointed and come out of, they're not together anymore. And it throws your expectation off and it throws off your biochemical reactions to food. And what she has come up with in her review of human research is that drinking artificially sweetened diet beverages doesn't seem to result in many studies, especially in adults, in lower weight.
Which is, after all, the whole point of the exercise, or
right.
should be.
And it doesn't seem to reduce the risk of metabolic syndrome and diabetes, which is another thing that we are concerned about.
So, John, in St. Petersburg, Florida, we hope that answered your question. We're so sorry that we didn't have time to take your call.
Dr. Swithers says, just don't drink soda.
go with water.
Water, iced tea, just don't drink soda.
And watch out for those artificial sweeteners. Well, that's all the time we have. Thank you so much for listening to The People's Pharmacy. Lynn Siegel produced today's show. Sophie Copeland provided technical assistance. Russ Henry and Al Wodarski are our engineers. Dave Graydon edits our interviews.
The People's Pharmacy is produced at the studios of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC.
The People's Pharmacy theme music is by B.J. Lederman.
Next week on The People's Pharmacy, we've got an amazing story about a child's recovery from severe arthritis. What does diet have to do with joints and the immune system?
Not only will we hear from the mom, but we'll hear from a doctor who has a rather interesting protocol to help people who may be suffering from this kind of problem. If you'd like to order today's show, you can call 800-732-2334. Today's show is number 910. That number again, 800-732-2334, or you can find it on the website, peoplespharmacy.com. You'll find an extended bonus interview with today's guest, Dr. Todd Hannaford, about hernia repair. And when you go to the website, you can look up prescription medications or dietary supplements, find out about herbs and home remedies, read other people's experiences, or share your own.
You can also sign up for our free email newsletter or subscribe to the free podcast of our show and share today's program with a friend. It's all there at peoplespharmacy.com.
In Durham, North Carolina, I'm Joe Graydon.
And I'm Terry Graydon. Thank you so much for listening, and please join us again next week.